This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Is here, right now, in conversation with Julia Wheeler. Please welcome Simon Reeve.
Hello, hello. I lost my tea, sorry. Morning.
Hello and welcome to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival. Thank you very much for squishing up and squeezing up to see Simon Reeve. I hope that means you've met some new friends already, made some new friends, potentially travelling companions. Before we even start, we're going to get all social media on you.
Oh, yes, yes. Sorry, I forgot. I did say I would forget, didn't I? Is there a Sally Murray? Is there a Sally Murray
over there,
here?
Sally Murray.
Sally
the
Murray. Hello, Sally. Hello. Happy birthday, Sally Murray. Hello. Can I say happy birthday to Sally Murray and say Dave says he's very, very sorry? What is Dave very, very sorry about? Wouldn't we like to know? Come on.
Can we get a microphone there?
One job in the year. Yeah.
So that I would be here to see you at 12 o'clock. And unfortunately, at 2 o'clock this morning, he was still drinking Metaxa.
Oh, okay.
Poor
well,
Dave.
You've made it, and we're pleased for that. I'm not very good on this social media malarkey, but somebody said, oh, you've had a tweet about Sally, who's in the audience. Anyway, we've done it now. Happy birthday. We won't sing, because it would just take too long, wouldn't it? Because we're all rubbish at singing. But happy birthday, Sally. Have a fantastic day. There we go. Okay.
Not
remembered.
So good at social...
Thank you for reminding
no, no
me.
No problem.
Put the phone away.
Not so good at social media, but very good at travelling.
Well,
120
that,
countries.
Yes, thank you.
And you clocked
for
up a few
me.
More in the last year, within
yes.
the last year. Turkey, Colombia, yeah. around the Arctic. Let's start with Turkey.
Okay.
You've said that you think this is one of the most important countries in the whole world.
Yeah.
And what was it that you found there, talking to the people, the things that you saw that brought you to that conclusion?
Yeah, I mean, Turkey's probably been certainly one of, but I would argue there's a case for saying it is the most important country in the world for a while now. Obviously, geographically, it's between Europe and the Middle East. Culturally, politically, in many ways, it's between both areas, and it's perhaps a bridge, a block, a barrier, a connection, all of the above. So that would be the reason why I would say it's so important. We decided we would make a TV series about Turkey. We decided we'd do it before the failed coup of last year, and we arrived a couple of weeks after the coup had been attempted. So very tricky time in Turkey's history, of course. And in time-honoured fashion, went on a journey around Turkey for a TV series to be called Turkey. It doesn't take a huge amount of imagination, I'll grant you, but the journey was glorious and tricky in equal measures, and we went on a big loop around circling Turkey, basically, starting on the European side in a glorious vineyard. I wasn't really aware that in an overwhelmingly Muslim country such a thing existed. But yes, there is quite a healthy wine industry in Turkey, rather delicious as well. I had obviously a few glasses just for the purposes of filming. And we went and we met a vineyard owner who'd given up his job working in IT to follow the dream, leave Istanbul, have a vineyard, produce wine, and then the government has taken a bit of a turn against such practices and has banned advertising. It's all become a bit tricky for him. But it's a beautiful place. We started there, Istanbul, around the turquoise coast. I say that badly, but the turquoise coast obviously gives Turkey its name. And then down along the Syrian border between Turkey and Syria, a very tricky part of the world, into the Kurdish area of the country, around Black Sea Mountains, up along the Black Sea coast, to Ankara, back to Istanbul. I'm condensing quite a lot down there, but you get the picture.
And it's going to be 2 hours on BBC later in the spring.
2 hours to try and tell the story of one of the
Such
most important countries
a diverse
in the
world. Nation.
Yes.
And one of the things that makes it so diverse is the minorities,
yeah.
the ethnic minorities. Who did you come across and whose stories did you tell from that perspective?
You're absolutely right. Turkey is... It's a curious thing, because it is obviously one of the oldest areas of the world that we have settled, and I was going to say civilized, which has negative connotations, but it's where human civilization really took root, in that area, and then obviously in the fertile valley between the Tigris and the Euphrates. That's the beginning of us in so many ways. And so that area is ancient. There is such incredible history in that part of the world. We know that, of course. But Turkey, as a modern country, is pretty new. It's less than 100 years old. It was formed as the country of the Turks, very specifically, and everyone within the borders was encouraged or forced, depending on your perspective, to become part of the nation of the Turks. So everybody under one flag, one people. And one of the great challenges for Turkey that it still hasn't managed to successfully wrestle with, as it were, is how it incorporates and deals with and accepts and loves its minority groups. So the relationship, of course, between the Turks and the Kurds, who most of us will have heard of, who are one of the biggest ethnic groups who don't have their own state throughout the Middle East, is phenomenally tricky and explosive and violent over recent decades. So we explored that. We went to Diyarbakir, which is one of the main Kurdish cities, and we were there at a very difficult time. The city's under semi-lockdown from the authorities. There's been a huge number of attacks in that part of the world. And the Turkish government has reacted, you could say, with overwhelming force, I think it's fair to say, to some Kurds who've attempted to declare autonomy for small areas of that. And they've responded with tanks and artillery, ludicrously over the top, quite frankly. But that's been what's going on, and we have to incorporate that into a programme that also includes the turquoise sea, the beautiful beaches, the Black Sea mountains, incredible characters we met there. So how did we manage to incorporate the ethnic minorities? It's tricky, frankly, as it is to come up with any sort of balance in a country like that, which shows the light and the shade, because that exists everywhere. We also filmed with the Yorick people, who are... that's not my phone, is it? That's the sort of thing I do, is leave the phone on.
It's probably Dave.
Probably. He's giving a ring. Yeah, he's just calling to apologise again. So we filmed with the Yorick nomads, who in some ways are the original people of Turkey. And they used to number in the hundreds of thousands and have tens of thousands of enormous black tents settled across or erected across the central Anatolian plains. And they've now dwindled to just a few who still go on the move with their goats, trekking across the country. And we went and we saw them. And I'm smiling when I think of them, because they were beautiful and wonderful and inspiring and really under pressure from the state trying to get them to settle and pay the taxes and so on. So we met them and we had an interesting encounter with them, I would say.
So how does it work with the BBC? Do you say, hey, I really fancy going to Turkey, I think there's a story there? Or do they say, we're thinking of doing a programme on Turkey, wouldn't Simon Reeve be a great person to head that?
Yeah, I'm not sure they ever say he would be great to head it, but I've got a sort of niche, as it were, that I've obviously been clinging on to with my fingernails for a while now. About half of the projects I've done, I suppose, have been my ideas, not that they're phenomenally complicated ideas, obviously, but about half now are being suggested by the BBC, which is great, of course, because I'm a freelance type with a mortgage, and, you know, so when somebody comes and says to you, what do you think, Turkey, do you think that would be interesting? You know, there's a sort of dialogue, I suppose.
So there's half a second, is there, where you think, not so sure?
There's probably more than half a second, right, actually, in truth. No, because I'm being slightly facetious and flippant about it, but fundamentally, yeah, I've travelled a lot, and nobody's more surprised about that I've got that job than me, but it gives me quite an understanding, I would claim, of the world and the stories that contained within it. So if somebody says to me, Turkey, 2-3 parts, whatever, I can instantly get a sense, because I've been there before, I know the place, I know the stories I like to tell, I sort of have a sense of, okay, yeah, that will work, we could do that, we can make that in the time we've got, we can tell these tales, I think it'll be okay, I think we'll get in, I think the Turks will allow us access, etc., etc. So there's a dialogue, I suppose, with the BBC where can it be done, should it be done, will it be interesting, will enough people watch it for us to justify the cost? Not that we are completely beholden to ratings, but there has to be some consideration of that. So, you know, the Urals, I've said this before, sorry, but the Urals would make a really interesting telly series. But in truth, on a Sunday night, are you going to switch from Downton or any of these other exotic pleasures that are on the other channels to watch the Urals? Probably not. So we have to balance what's fascinating, important, interesting against what's realistic, I suppose. So a lot of the shows I've done have traded on the exotic titles of parts of our world, whether it's Australia, the equator, the Caribbean, Tropic of Cancer, etc. There's a feeling about those areas that people, some people anyway, some maybe in the audience even, kindly will go, all right, that sounds sort of interesting, as we're flicking through what's called the electronic program guide. This is the sort of thing we're a slightly slave to now, the EPG, which is what you see, not you lot, but the fickle British TV viewers as they flick through the channels, and it just comes up, you know, Downton, let's see what's on the other side, the Urals, no, Caribbean, maybe, yeah, yeah. The poor old Urals. It would be really interesting, but I have to come up with ideas, and we have to come up with ideas that sort of contain a sort of exotic appeal and proper stories, because for me, that is the joy of travel, finding out interesting things and having an interesting experience.
It's a thin line, isn't it, when you're travelling for TV, I would imagine, where you've got to be excited and you've got to have a look of wonder about you because this is new and you've got a TV camera there and people want to see it through your eyes.
Yeah.
But to retain the respect and take the mick out of what's different, because you're there because it's different, but you don't want to be disrespectful. How do you manage that?
Ooh. I've got better at it, I would say, but as an example, there's several things contained in that. Yes, you have to infuse about a place or a situation in a way that is probably more than the normal person would, and there's definitely times when we're seeing something or experiencing something and I get a bit overexcitable. Partly because I am overexcitable after a cup of tea or something, but partly because that is the job. I'm supposed to present a TV show, and there's an element where if I just stick to monotone, you know, people won't realise this is important or interesting. But there are times when people look at me, including the rest of the team, and they go, are you all right? You know, or the director or Jonathan or Craig, the cameraman I often work with, they'll go, I think you should calm a bit down, you know, you're getting a bit carried away, and conversely they'll say, you know, we'll all think, okay, we need to accept that what we're seeing here is actually something quite emotional and important, and we need to be respectful of that. Respectful of culture and differences is a very tricky area, because I am respectful of differences, but at the same time I think there are areas where some things are right and some things are wrong, and we have to balance a degree of respect for the culture we're in with the external knowledge that actually it's not great to treat women like that, for example. Or, you know, that horse, no, you should not be riding that. It's close to death. This is sort of wrong. And yet, at the same time, we have to balance all the conflicting situations around that. And the morality of it is hard to judge and understand. I'm sure we all face that challenge sometimes. So I don't always get it right by any means. And there's a little, when you were saying that, I was thinking there's a clip in this new Turkey series I've done. It's just a tiny little thing, but look out for it, because I'm not sure. I think it was a little bit patronising. I'm going into somebody's house, and it's in what used to be described as a shanty area of Istanbul, and they're giving me some slippers to wear in their house, and my tone is just a little bit too, ooh, slippers, wonderful, thank you so much. And it's just a bit much, and we've sort of let it go, because hopefully you'll forgive me for it, but it's just a little bit, patronising almost. So I definitely don't get it right, but I have learnt, I think, that TV is a critical viewer, and how to sort of attempt to annoy as least people as possible. That's all I can hope for.
Well, you're reminding us that obviously it's not just you. There's a whole team of people behind you. Mm. And I wonder, given that, you know, you're sometimes in pretty tricky situations and you're with these people for a long time.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of this in terms of tips for companions if people are going away as well.
Yeah.
How do you, on those long trips, maintain the love and the balance between that team? often many of whom will have their own egos and their own thoughts.
Yeah, they're pretty egoless. actually. I don't know why, but when you say that, pops into my head, actually. I was just filming in Colombia, and I was filming as part of our team. I travel with just four people, generally. And that's a cameraman, cameraman, a producer-director, and an assistant producer. And they all work so much harder than I do, as you can imagine. I just have to make sure that I'm reasonably well slept and that I've got a few things to say, basically. But when you say that about the ego, no, it's really not... I cannot accept that about the rest of the team. The presenter, definitely. But as an example, we had an assistant producer filming in Colombia just now who, if you look at his stats on paper, right, he is 26... He is a really good-looking Italian male rugby player who's also a TV presenter in his own right, who presents for Al Jazeera and lives in Caracas in Venezuela, who's done a lot of travelling. But 26 is a, you know, it's an age when you're trying to be a manly man, etc. And on paper, I would say that he would come across as having a fair old-sized ego on that basis. But he grafted and did the tricky, boring jobs, the going to get water, the paying... It was totally ego-free and listened and learned and gave advice. And it was pitch perfect. So the teams I've worked with, I've been incredibly lucky most of the time. Inevitably, there are moments where personalities collide, if not egos. That's often my fault. Sometimes it's the other person. Sometimes it's just not fault. It's just what happens. For advice, I would say for tricky places, I just make sure that I'm not going anywhere with somebody who's madder than me, which I think is very important.
Good advice.
We have sort of basic rules about if we're in a tricky situation and one person says, I think we should go, we go. No questions, we just walk. And we would do the equivalent of, just putting the camera down and walking out if it was required. Depends on the situation. But there are times when we have to think in that sort of way.
And have you had to do that?
No, we've never left a camera behind, but we've certainly walked at speed, hustling out of places. Usually with me going the fastest, of course. In fact, you saw a clip of it if people saw that. We were in what turned out to be a drug den in Cape Town, which was entirely my fault for taking us in there because I got a bit carried away. We'd been filming in a township outside Cape Town, and we've been filming this story about this drug issue. I'm trying to shorten down the big story, and somebody had said, oh, you need to go and speak to the crazy man down the street, and that literally is what they said. And to my shame, that I thought, that sounds like a great idea, let's go and speak to the crazy man down the street. We walk in there, and the others, just with two guys at that point, they're, one's filming, so he's just seeing through here, and expensive cameras actually only show it in black and white so that you can see the focus. His other eyes closed. And then Andrew, who was with Jonathan, the cameraman, Andrew's just making sure he doesn't trip over stuff. So I'm just in there as the point man seeing everything, and I realise this is not a good place for us to be, but we're in here now. It would be worse if we leave. And I have to sort of make a decision on that. It hasn't been wrecked. There's no bodyguard with me there. We've got a couple of people from the local community, but it's risky, and it's yet another moment when the hairs on my arms go up as I think about it. So there has to be a lot of trust amongst the team. And TV's a weird thing. I went to Mogadishu once with a team that I met for the first time at the airport to go there. Now, that is not what you ideally want to do. You want to have been bloodied and bonded together before you go, but TV can chuck people together. That hasn't happened for a while. Now I generally work with people drawn from a small team, but yeah, don't go with anyone madder than you, I would say, but go with interesting people with stories to tell, of course.
So you mentioned Colombia. Tell us what you were filming there and some of the people that you met there.
I was filming in Colombia, yeah, until very recently, actually. Feels bizarre to... Here I was in Colombia. Who's been to Colombia? All right, good. One, two... Oh, not enough hands going up for Colombia. Okay, in the booth as well. Very good. That's fantastic. But more people, I think, probably will be going there soon. Only about 50,000, I think it is, 50,000 or 25,000, anyway, Brits go to Colombia each year, compared to, say, 2.5 million who go to Turkey each year. People haven't been going, obviously, because it's got a reputation for cocaine and conflict, and it's certainly still got the former, but a lot less of the latter, thank goodness, and that was the reason why we went. We went because... You probably know there was a peace deal that's been developing over several years that was signed at the end of last year. Hopefully brings an end to a devastating conflict that's gone on there for 50 years now. 200,000 people dead, 7 million Colombians displaced within Colombia, internally displaced people. So incredible suffering. Almost every Colombian you meet, I don't know if you had this experience when you were there, but everyone has a story to tell of how they've been connected in some way to the catastrophes that have affected the country. But hopefully now, the peace deal means that there is a chance for the country. If they can address some of the extraordinary problems, some of the other extraordinary problems the country faces, which is largely poverty and inequality. It's one of the most unequal countries in the world. In the Americas, only Haiti is more unequal. So loads of incredibly poor people, tiny number of incredibly wealthy, clinging on to that money, that wealth and that land, and that really has to change. But it's a beautiful, beautiful place. It's got so much to offer. I was in, started filming in Cartagena up on the coast. I don't know if you went there. Very beautiful. Really, got to be a tourist hotspot. I mean, it's more Havana-y in some ways than Havana in a strange way. And then just off the coast, this is the Caribbean coast of this country. It has a Caribbean coastline, for goodness sake, which a lot of people don't realise. There are a group of islands called the Rosario Islands, which are absolutely stunning. So we started the programme there on these beautiful islands, tiny little specks in the sea, of course, but just half an hour from Cartagena, a bit like the Maldives, really, but in the Caribbean. Absolutely gorgeous, little boutique hotels, I'm sure one or two of you will end up on your travels. Glorious place. But we did that, you know, we really travelled around. We were down in the jungle at one of the last FARC camps, the FARC guerrillas. We went on a raid on an illegal gold mine. I had no idea. Illegal gold mining in South America now earns more money for criminal gangs than drug production. I had no idea. It's one of the biggest causes of deforestation in Colombia. So we went on this extraordinary raid of an illegal gold mine with 180 heavily armed troops who blew up the diggers that we were that were doing the mining. Anyway, goodness, I'm going right back into that. It's an extraordinary place, a really critical time in that country's history, which for me makes it so much more interesting and important to visit at the moment, because everyone's got a story. You were asking about a specific, and I've gone on with general, sorry. One little story. Can I tell about a restaurant?
Yeah, please do.
Sorry. So we went for, I think it's called El Mielo, in Medellin, if anyone's been there. El Mielo, I think it was. Anyway, look up fancy, slightly poncy, molecular gastronomy restaurant in Medellin, and I bet it pops up. And the food is incredible. I only had a little dish, unfortunately, but the real story for us there and why we filmed there was because the celeb chef there has got this great Jamie Oliver-style college or training session centre where he's also trained up 300 or more special chefs to work in his kitchens. But all of his chefs are former combatants from the conflict. And we had this beautiful moment when we were filming in the kitchens there, and it was quite cramped, and so there are a few people standing very close together with their arms around each other. Oh, it makes me well up thinking about it. And they were, one of them was a former FARC guerrilla, one of them was a former member of a paramilitary right-wing death squad, and the other was a former Colombian army soldier who'd been blown to pieces in a FARC landmine and had lost a leg, his eye, part of his face, incredibly traumatised by it. And they were all standing there, former enemies, victims as well, because everybody's a victim in this situation in this country, with their arms around each other, friends now. And it was just such a hopeful moment that they might find peace there. And God, I do pray that they're capable of that.
What a privilege to have been there.
The word. It really was. Yeah. Privileged.
Yeah. So you've been to some nice hot places, but you've also been to some chilly ones within the last year.
Yeah.
And Arctic Live, the clue's in the title, it was live. What are the challenges, not only of live TV, but of doing live TV in those sort of temperatures?
What are the challenges? Yes.
You had quite thick gear on for the whole thing, didn't you?
Quite thick pants. Yes, I did. Yes. What are the challenges? Well, the challenge of live, as you say, that I hadn't fully appreciated in advance, and I'd never really done live TV. So this is a series I did that was on last year, and I was a sort of least experienced junior presenter on it. There was also Kate Humble, who was helming it, and Gordon Buchanan, who's, they were both brilliant. And then there's me, microphone, standing in the cold, chatting away, you know. And part of me loved it. I did get a bit of a rush from it, and it's a little bit tricky to get my ticker properly going away now, properly ticking. So I enjoyed that slight thrill. The challenge with it compared to filming for hours, you know, and then finding quality in that quantity, is, I suppose, getting serious information out of people in the 2.5 minutes that you've been given in the slot. And I felt a real responsibility for that, because we are in a part of the world that is changing very rapidly, very dramatically, that really matters to all of us in ways that we don't fully appreciate. You know, the world is one connected system. It is our only world. This is heating up there in the north. It's heating faster than anywhere. It is melting. It is changing. It regulates the temperature of our planet. If we melt the ice up there and we lose the polar cap, you know what happens when you go from a white surface to a dark surface. Dark absorbs more heat. You get this feedback loop that means the planet will heat even faster because it absorbs more sunlight. So it really matters. I'm standing there talking to a professor of climate science who's one of the world's leading experts on the Arctic, and I don't want to screw it up, and I want us to get the right information out. So that was the moment that was really tricky for me, making sure that I said the right things, that we conveyed together the right information to you who've paid for us to be there, etc. And also because I just think it's important that you know what's going on in our world as best as is possible. So that was the really hard bit. Technically, camera batteries do not like minus 20 degrees, it transpires. So warmer packs, you have to slap those on the side of the batteries. And Jonathan, who's a cameraman I've worked with a lot, who I mentioned earlier, who was also filming on this, he came up with this idea of buying pet warmer beds, like dog and cat warmer beds, 12-volt things you can plug into a SIG socket. And those were blanketed around the batteries to help them charge up overnight. So, you know, they have to be inventive in these situations. But technically, they did. It was extraordinary. I thought, this is not going to work. I'm a cynic by training and by background. So I was amazed. Yeah, I thought, this is going to be a disaster. What have I got involved in? They were trying to broadcast live from, you know, the other part, almost the other side of the world, bouncing off one satellite. There's no backup. It turned out I was the fallback guy if the other two presenters' camera systems went down, because they were slightly more remote than I was. And they only told me that half an hour before I went on, not to worry me. Brilliant. It was okay.
Cameramen are some of the most inventive people in the world, I think. But which gives me a lovely little link to Big Life Fix. Because that is
like
the
it.
New... Do you see what I did there? That is the new departure for you. Has anybody seen Big Life Fix? Who liked it?
Thank you, both of you.
Thank you. just tell us a little bit about how that differs and what you were trying to do with that programme.
Well, it's completely different to anything I've done before. And it's called Big Life Fix, and it was on the telly end of last year. And it's basically a pretty irrelevant presenter and a group of incredible boffins who are coming up with inventions for people in often really life-critical, extraordinary situations. So Graham, one volunteer who his family wanted some help for him, he has locked-in syndrome, or a version of locked-in syndrome, which is about as bad as it gets for us, frankly, and can't communicate, still completely awake and coherent inside, but can't talk, can barely move, really tricky, and the boffins built a means for him to communicate that was just beautiful, frankly, to witness and be a part of. I mean, honestly, I think I was there to try and be a telly presenter. It was, they sort of said, can you actually be a telly presenter? It was a sort of test in a way. And the idea was that I would bring some, I suppose, some humanity to it in a way, because we thought they're boffins, you know, laboratories, that's what they know. Turned out they all had massive beating hearts and souls and were quite capable of understanding and empathising. But anyway, so my job was to sort of say, what's a transistor or a capacitor or something like that, and, you know, talk about the human side of it. But, it was an experience for me, because normally I'm really intimately involved in structuring and sometimes even doing a bit of research, carrying the bags, working away, writing the script as well, making unhelpful comments on the edit, etc. On this, I was much less involved. It wasn't really my project, but it was absolutely an honour to be part of.
One thing that really struck me was obviously the people who were being helped were delighted and emotional, but sometimes it was the people who were helping who got so much out of it as well. Mm.
Yeah. I think they did. So the boffins, yeah. I mean, I don't mean that in a negative way at all. It's maybe a bit flippant almost, but they're geniuses. Yeah. But proper geniuses with hearts and souls as well, not just intellectually incredible. Yeah. So, yeah, they're really moved and touched by it. In fact, I was in, because I'm not often huge amount in London, and luckily for me, in a way, my visit to be here, frankly, over the last few days coincided with James, who was one of the volunteers. James Dunn, who, if you saw it, he was a lad, young man in the wheelchair. He's got a chronic skin condition, no collagen binding his skin together. A really extraordinary man, very mature, interesting, funny, clever, trapped within his body in many ways. He's at St. Thomas's having an extraordinary operation at the moment, so I was able to meet up with him. And Jude, who was a boffin who'd worked with him, came along. We saw him together. We had a lovely chat and a cup of tea. It was just really, really warm and lovely, actually. The boffins have kept in touch with the people they're with. They're friends, and it's been a lovely aspect of it. Yeah.
Something for our times. Good.
Yeah.
So let's get the microphone out if we can, and stick your hand up if you've got a question for Simon, maybe about some of the places that he's been to. There's a question just here to start with, and we'll come to you in a second, or the practicalities, or whatever you want to ask.
Could you tell me, on these filmings you do, how many weeks or months in each of these locations, say the Turkey, how long are you in there doing the programme, and the same with the one in South America as well?
Yeah, thank you for that. How long? It varies to a certain extent, but I'd say roughly 3 weeks. 3 weeks per programme for me, which in some ways sounds mad, 3 weeks to film for an hour of TV. It's not cheap, you know, to get a whole camera crew on the road moving around the place. So we try and limit it down as much as possible, but we want to get variety in. We don't have a recce, so nobody really goes out ahead and works out what I'm going to do or say. We don't have a script, which saves a bit of money. So I've given quite a lot of freedom to make it up as we go along, basically. But yeah, about 3 weeks. I've done much longer trips. I did one where I followed the Tropic of Cancer, for example, around the world. And this was, I think, 5.5 weeks. So this is the Tropic of Cancer line here, obviously the line that marks the northern border of the tropics. And to go across here to down here, very close to this oasis, in fact, that took a bit of time, as you can imagine. We were going across borders there that hadn't been crossed in about, 20 years, Westerners hadn't been across the border here. And we managed to persuade, this is a while ago, managed to persuade customs people from Tripoli under Gaddafi to fly down and open it up for us. It was quite an extraordinary experience. And that's what the BBC can make happen, if you like. It's not for me, obviously, it's for the BBC, but really it's for you, because they're impressed that you'll be watching, you know. So amazing things can happen, but we try and limit the time. Thank you.
There's a question just here.
Hello.
Hi, Simon. You've half answer my question when I'm going to develop it. No, because when you choose a country you're going to go, I was going to ask, what degree of plan, strategy, locations, or do you just go there? It sounds like you go there. So when you arrived in Turkey, how do you develop a, we're going to go to this place, then we want to find out about those people? And how much research has gone on somewhere behind the scenes, or are you literally using fixes and ideas and spontaneity in country?
It's a great question, and it's a bit of both, I didn't even see Roddy down there. Very impressive. He must have got into a trap door. So a bit of both. So as I was just saying, we don't have a script, but we've got a clear idea of what we're going to do. But TV people love to, you know, because time is money, etc. They love writing everything down. 909, we will get into the car and drive to XX. So we're given much more freedom than that. But we do know in advance, for example, that there are the Yorick Nomads, who I mentioned. They will be roughly in this location. We would like to go and see them. And in that, as an example, we've spoken to people who know that community, who will meet us at another point and will come with us, who you probably won't see on camera. You actually do in that case, but normally you wouldn't. So we've got some planning done in advance. We've got a rough schedule. We don't have to keep to that if something more interesting arises. And often we will see something, we will be told something that will mean, okay, let's go that way rather than that way, and we'll see what happens. And that is, it's a great, it's yet another privilege, frankly. So it's not, we're not running on rails. We've got a plan, because we need to have that, otherwise we'd be squandering your money. But we can really, really freestyle, if you like, really be spontaneous if there's some justification for it. Thank you. Hello.
Hello. So your journey through Burma was compulsive and very...
It's all right.
...very stressful at times, and you camped down for the night, and then you had to get out as soon as possible. Then you had that young girl with you who was under some sort of threat as well. So just how close were you, and do you know how that young girl is doing now?
Thank you for that. So, ladies mentioning, I did a journey, same one actually, Tropic of Cancer, a number of years ago. The beauty of following this sort of random imaginary line is that it forced us to go to parts of the world outsiders don't normally visit. So once you've got that idea or conceit almost, then follow that line where almost wherever it goes. It's a brilliant way to travel. I would really recommend it. It's one of the most... incredible experiences I've had following mad lines around the world. I'm following a river as well. I did a series where I followed sacred rivers, river from source to sea. Coming up with something like that, where you go from A through to F, you know, and you have a journey and adventure along the way. And what you're mentioning is we went from northeastern India, illegally actually, into Burma on... this was a while ago, it's about 7-8 years ago, I think, when we did this. So obviously Burma's changed dramatically since then. But we went into an area where the Chin people live, who are a persecuted Christian minority, and they still are there. It was actually very tricky, and it was one of the most, one of the trickiest things I've done for TV in many ways. And it's a shame that you didn't see more of the prep in a way, but I suppose in many ways it would be quite boring. But we had endless meetings and discussions, poring over maps and satellite maps. We were basically walking illegally, as I say, from northeastern India, the Seven Sister States, if anyone's been there. It's a bit of India nobody really knows about, but Tripura, Mizoram, Nagaland, that sort of area. Really recommend it. It's very remote. Hill tribes, lots of hill tribes there. And we crossed the border on foot into Burma. We walked to a village that had agreed to receive us. We met the people there. We had a local guide who was one of the bravest people I've ever met, who is from that community but was living in exile in Thailand, actually, because, yes, she was on a Burmese military death list, and if we'd been caught, she would almost have been almost certainly been executed on the spot. So I'm not... It was as clear and that as that, and we talked endlessly... Do you really want to take this risk? And she did. And that should humble all of us, because their lives are so extreme compared to ours. She's prepared to risk her life for a TV show, for goodness sake, to show the outside world what's going on to her community. And obviously we tried to be professional about it. We took an enormous amount of advice. We had guides ahead of us who were monitoring for Burmese military patrols. We'd mapped out, using satellite images, the location of army bases. We had a lot of intelligence from the community there, but there was always a risk that something would go badly wrong. And we had to try and prep and prepare for that. We couldn't use satellite phones, actually. which was a slightly tricky situation because in that part of the world, there's several insurgencies, and we were told quite clearly, if you make a satellite call, it can be spotted, triangulated, and both sides, Indians and Burma, lob artillery or mortars onto the spot where the call's coming from. So it was a scary situation to be in. And, you know, however tense it was to watch, I know you know, it was quite something to do. But we felt that it was... We felt it was important, to be honest. I mean, telly is just telly, but sharing stories from around the world, that's something really powerful that telly can do, and so we felt that there was a justification for it. Thank you for reminding me of it, though. Thank you.
Question over here.
Hi, Simon.
Hello.
I really enjoyed the Caribbean mini-series that you did.
Thank you.
I lived for 2 years in the Turks and Caicos Islands, but I found it quite hard to island hop because quite often you had to go back to America and then fly out again to right. the next island. Where would you recommend, because I'd like to revisit and explore?
Goodness. Where would I like to revisit and explore? It's interesting you say about hopping via America, because I can't do that at the moment, it would seem. So coming back from Colombia... The cheapest flights with BBC Always Books, contrary to what you probably think or read in the Daily Mail. So the cheapest economy flights were going via Miami, and they tried to get me an ESTA to go via the States. And I've been denied an ESTA because my sort of range of places I've been includes some countries they're not very happy with at the moment, like Sudan. I think in Congo even there was a problem with them, Somalia, etc., etc. I feel a bit incensed by this. I warned them about terrorism before 9/11. I have the dubious honour of having written the first book on Osama bin Laden. Doesn't cut any ice with the American embassy, I tell you. So I couldn't fly via America. I went by Madrid, and that was lovely. But anyway, so hopping via the States is a bit tricky now. But where would I go back to? Goodness me, I would honestly... what I've done for telly has... Every journey has been extraordinary, and I thank you for it because I know the privilege that it is. But I do think the way I've been lucky enough to travel is... It's more interesting than often what we're sold by the travel industry. Travel with your eyes open... Go looking for interesting stuff, stories and people. Go for the extreme. I mean, really mean that. Don't go for the bland, ever. The club flipping sandwich, never. No, go for the crazy food, the crazy drink, the crazy bar, the memorable situation, the memorable place. And it's so much more rewarding as a result. So there is nowhere that I have been that I would not love to go back to at a shot, quite frankly, because everywhere is interesting and everyone has got a story. And that's not knocking the travel industry. Goodness, they give us what we want and ask for. So if we ask for more rewarding experiences, then they will give it to us. But, you know, I'm sorry to drone on about it because I have done once or twice before, but don't sit by the pool. It's, you know, maybe for a day, but get out there, get out and experience life in its raw beauty. You don't have to ignore the problems of a place. You have to eat some crazy food, as I say, and you have to have experiences. That's what travel should be. And then you'll always want to go back everywhere, I think. Thank you.
I think we've probably got time for one more question. There's a good question at the back. The gentleman in the blue.
I'm hoping for a complaint. But
hi. No complaint, sorry. You've been to some amazing places, as you say, but what do you do for personal holiday? And how does it compare?
The gentleman's saying, I don't know if you'll heard, I've been very lucky. There was a slight note of envy in his voice, I thought, there, but maybe not. I do know I've been very lucky. And where do I go? That I actually pay for? Greece a few times. I stump up for Greece. My wife speaks fluent Greek, which helps. And when we first got together, she's half Danish and is slightly obsessed with Greece, frankly. And, you know, in that blokey way where you sort of react against what's actually quite good. It's, I don't really want... I don't want to go to Greece. I don't want to go to Denmark. And then I sort of had this moment where I thought, hang on, you know, she could have come from some Central European mining town. I've done all right here. And I embraced it and went with it. And Greece is stunning. And It's not the other side of the planet. It's warm, it's welcoming. It would probably be my choice of another nationality if I couldn't be a Brit. You know, they do all right there. So Greece, Denmark we go to because the in-laws are there, Christmas there, dancing around the Christmas tree, very hoogly. I'm sure you're familiar with the phrase. So I've stumped up for there, but I've got a lad now who's wanting to have a few adventures of his own, so we'll have to start thinking further afield. But I've done some lovely adventures in Europe as well, and, you know, although we go further and we go for longer, you know, Europe is an extraordinary place to explore. I've been by train to Istanbul from London, and that's a hell of an experience. We mustn't overlook that the journey is part of the story, and the journey can be very much part of the experience. So long train journeys is something I love as well, and I'm happy to do those with my lad. I'll stump for those. But I didn't go on a plane until I started working. We went abroad once when I was a lad. So I grew up quite near here and went to an ordinary school, very ordinary background. I'm not a posh public school boy. I've changed my estuary accent to try and fit in and be acceptable, but I know I've been very lucky, I really do. But thank you for the question.
There is a gentleman who's waiting terribly patiently. Really quick question, really quick answer.
Gotcha.
First of all, thank you very much for what you said about Colombia. It's a country I know well, and it is, I think, at an important transition now. I wanted to ask you about your programme where you were on the border between Colombia and Venezuela and filming the people smuggling petrol in their cars and currency smuggling as well. That looked a little bit dangerous to me, and I'm wondering what your relations with the local police force was like.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Quick answer, got that. Gentleman's mentioning a journey I did where I was very lucky to travel around the Caribbean, as you do, and we went from, Venezuela into Colombia. Venezuela obviously having a very tricky time at the moment into glorious Colombia, for a gentleman from the Colombian Tourist Board over here. But, the border was and is quite tricky. I wouldn't say dangerous, tricky, I would say, if you're careful. I mean, I'm sorry, I know I haven't got a lot of time, but I have to preface the remarks by saying I think the big realisation for me since I started travelling a lot, the world is such a safe and welcoming place. Don't be put off from getting out there. Yes, there are tricky parts of it. If you're careful, if you're not flashing your cash or your camera, you're almost guaranteed to be safe everywhere. Seatbelt, can't click, you're okay. So we travelled through a fairly lawless part of the world. We went low profile. We travelled in local cars with blacked out windows so nobody could see in. And we crossed our fingers a little bit. We didn't have any relationship, as it were, with the local cops. Probably not wise, as they were almost certainly in on most of the smuggling anyway. It's an extraordinary sight that you see there as you go through. I mean, people with motorbikes roaring through jungle paths, carrying big fuel canisters on their back, because petrol is basically free in Venezuela due to government muppetry, and is rather expensive in Colombia. So guess what? People smuggle it over the border. It's almost guaranteed to happen. But honestly, I cannot stress this clearly enough. The world, you look at this incredible planet we live on, at this incredible time when we can travel almost everywhere. Travel further, please. Go and have more adventurous experiences, because if you're careful and you use this, you can go almost anywhere. Then my job is to look for the tricky places and find the stories and perhaps a bit of darkness as well. But almost everywhere we go to, I see Brits, particularly because we're adventurous, but foreign travellers, basically, having an incredible time. Don't be put off from doing that. I know you're not, because you've been to Colombia lots. Good for you, sir.
Fantastic. We could carry on talking all afternoon with all your adventures, but we have to leave
it
there.
Give me a cup of tea. And
Simon is going to be over at the Stanford's stand signing his book, so go and carry on the conversations over there. Thanks very much for coming.
Thank you so much. Thank you for coming over. Appreciate it. Can we say thank you as well to Julia? Don't cut me off. I want to say thank you. Thank you, guys, as well.
Thank you.